on tape. So it's September 13th at around 11 o'clock in the morning. I'm Kim Schaefer. Stephen Mintz is also connected by phone, and I'm sitting here with Steve Einhorn of Omega Advisors and formerly of Goldman Sachs. And Steve, if I may, would you kindly consent for the record to our taping this interview?
Sure, you have my consent to tape the interview.
Thank you. And if you wouldn't mind, again, for the record to, allow me to start. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was established by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis, to hold hearings, and to write a report that is due in December to Congress and the President. And there are a number of listed causes we were supposed to investigate, as well as institutions that failed or would or came near to failure but for government intervention. I should also say to you, although I have no reason whatsoever to think you would say anything inaccurate, that given that this is a federal agency, were you to say something inaccurate, that would be a crime. But I have no reason to consider going down that road. Would you mind, please, just as part of the record, giving us a bit of the benefit of your background? I did try to look it up, but let's have it in your words.
Okay. Hi, my name is Steve Einhorn. I am currently a vice chairman of Omega Advisors, which is a long-short equity hedge fund headquartered in New York. I joined Omega in May of 1999, having retired from Goldman Sachs in December of 1998. I was employed by Goldman Sachs between early 1977 and the end of 1998. I was made a partner at Goldman Sachs in November of 1986. When I retired, I was partner in charge of global investment research. Prior to joining Goldman Sachs in, I believe it was May of 1977, I was a portfolio strategist in the common stock department at Prudential Insurance Company, which I joined, I believe, in 1972 and was there until, again, May of 1977.
Great. Thank you. So we can take this conversation in a number of directions. Stephen has some questions about antecedents and inflection points that I think he would like to ask. But let me open in a more open-ended way by asking you, what do you think were the primary driving causes of the financial crisis based on your wisdom and experience?
Well, there's no simple answer because it's a fairly complicated process involving a fairly complicated financial system in the U.S. and globally. If I had to put it in terms of bullet points, important contributing factors, I think one, which actually isn't talked enough about, is that housing became largely unaffordable for the first-time home buyer as home prices increased rapidly. And one can argue that they increased rapidly because of household formation, they increased rapidly because of the Federal Reserve's policy of keeping interest rates low, because individuals began to assume that these were good investments and protective against inflation. There was speculation on second family or second homes. But whatever the reasons, it did become apparent that homes or home prices, housing prices, began to lock out the initial buyer, the first-time home buyer. And once you did that, then the appreciation of an existing home by in the family, they didn't have the opportunity to seize upon that appreciation to buy a second, to buy another home, more expensive, with the profits from the first home. So that process started to weaken home prices. And I think that was, I think, an important contributor. And again, not talked about very much, but if one looks at the various affordability indices with respect to housing, they clearly dipped well below their long-term average. And that, I think, explains how the home price weakness started. Doesn't fully explain the extent of decline, but does explain at least how that process started. Once it's, so that's reason number, or a reason for financial tsunami that we experienced was weaker home prices owing to the first-time home buyer. The second is a number of structured products were priced and rated as if a nationwide housing price decline was a very unlikely event. There was talk from various government as well as private economists and officials that housing was a localized market, a function of local economics rather than nationwide, and that housing therefore provided a diversified portfolio, which argued against a consistent, broad-based, nationwide, coincident decline. And as a consequence, I think securities based on mortgages, mortgage-backed securities as an example, were rated by the various rating agencies on the basis that a broad-based nationwide decline would be unlikely in terms of housing, and therefore diversified baskets of mortgage-backed securities would have low risk because of geographic diversification. And as it turns out, housing was more subject to a broad-based housing, home prices were subject to a more broad-based decline than most imagined. And as a consequence, these baskets of securities held on bank balance sheets and other balance sheets were subject to losses that were unexpected. And those losses had the effect of denting corp bank balance sheets, constraining lending, depressing bank earnings, all of which had the effect of constraining and depressing economic activity. Third, and related, in the environment of the mid and latter decade, a shadow banking system developed, securitized lending, which also fueled and funded debt extensions in the housing area. It turned out to be a less than stable source of funding when housing prices turned down, and when banks, suffering their own losses, were unwilling and or unable to provide funds to the shadow banking system. And that system, or that market, more or less disappeared. And as it disappeared, that compounded and exaggerated the decline in home prices, which part of which that securitized market was funding. So that's a third, I guess it's number three, I'm not quite sure, third
yes.
Element or cause, if you will, in the financial crisis that we experienced in 2008 and early 2009. And I think as well, while this was happening, there was, I think, an increasing loss of confidence in the funding of financial institutions. These financial institutions, as you know, require, the non-bank ones in particular, require steady funding of their inventory on a daily basis from large commercial banks. And with the experience of Bear Stearns, which had some of the issues that I've discussed, mortgage-backed securities, a writing down of those. It called into question on the part of investors whether or not these non-bank financial institutions were viable. And in a financial system like ours, which thrives or requires confidence in this liquidity, when that confidence began to dissipate on the part of investors, these companies' share prices went down. That was a signal to other investors that there was financial sector vulnerability in the non-bank sector. And then the issue developed of counterparty risk, which is, as you know, a very complicated issue. No one quite knows who the counterparties are, particularly in the opaque markets of derivatives, over-the-counter derivatives. And you had then this unfortunate unleashing of a drop in investor confidence in the non-bank financial institutions in terms of could they be funded, what was their vulnerability to other counterparties who might have these toxic assets on their books, mortgage-backed baskets, for example, and no one knew answers. And when you don't know answers in the financial structure, what happens is liquidity freezes. And as liquidity froze, the lifeblood of the economy, credit extensions, collapsed. Aggravating all of this, clearly, was the Lehman collapse, and the AIG issues. The AIG issues highlighted significantly the counterparty risks that non-bank and banks were exposed to, and the Lehman failure indicated that the government would allow, rightly or wrongly, but would allow a major financial institution to fail, or couldn't stop it from failing. There's some debate there. So I think all of that, I didn't mean to ramble, but all of that, I think, helps describe some of the causes for the financial crisis that we experienced. And at the core of it, or not at the core, but an important part of it was an increasing lack of confidence in the financial system to sustain itself, owing to lack of liquidity, lack of investor confidence, counterparty risk, etc. But there are other reasons, as I indicated. But that's sufficient to start, at least.
It's a very thoughtfully worded, one could almost print what you just said, description. So thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Given your decades of background in watching and insights into markets, without sort of repeating what you just explained to us, why was this crisis different from other stock market or other bubbles bursting? Obviously, this was more the debt markets in some dimension, but please talk about that.
Well, I guess there are two ways to frame it. One, we have had bear markets before. We have had economic contractions before. So that's not unusual. But the bulk of those bear markets in equities or risk assets and the bulk of economic contractions have typically been owing to an overheating economy generating inflation, which the Fed feels should be reversed because inflation is problematic and their dual mandate is both price stability and unemployment. And as inflation accelerates, the Fed takes the punch from the punch bowl, to a quote McChesney Martin, a long ago Federal Reserve Board of Governors chairman. And the Fed does that, and as it does it, the economy begins to slow. And as the economy slows and you enter recession, the market, being a discount mechanism, goes into bear markets. And we have had as you know, repetitive experiences. So that's not unusual. Bubbles are different. Bubbles tend not to be a function of overheating economies where the Fed removes the punch from the punch bowl. They tend to be sourced in an asset being discovered as undervalued for whatever reason, and investors increasingly accepting that undervaluation and committing ever more funds to it, to the point where the undervalued asset becomes overvalued. And that overvaluation is a bubble, and when it is pricked, there are economic consequences depending upon where the bubble resides. One important point to make is that whereas the Fed is quite capable of slowing an economy, generating a lot of inflation, and as the economy is in recession, easing policy enough to get us out of a recession, bubble experiences don't lend themselves to the Fed near as effectively. The Fed, first of all, can't identify them as easily. That is, they are better equipped, as anybody would be, in identifying problematic inflation than they are saying some asset is overvalued, because that's a much more subjective, much more market-determined issue, and the Fed has always been reluctant to identify bubbles. Secondly, it is more difficult for them to burst those bubbles, even if they could identify them. And third, when it is burst, for whatever reason, easy money policy is not as effective in reversing the negative economic consequences of a bubble bursting as is reversing an economy that overheated and the Fed put into recession. So that's the distinction, and I think an important one, between what we normally experience, bear markets, recessions, and bubble episodes. This bubble was more problematic than other bubbles we experienced, as you know, in 2001 and 2000, the internet bubble. The NASDAQ was down over 50%. Many internet companies went bankrupt. But it had a short-lived impact on the economy. We had a mild recession in 2000, 2001. The markets began to recover in 2002, 2003. And we had 4 or 5 years of very robust economic growth. I shouldn't say robust, we had sustained economic growth and reasonably good equity markets. But that was a bubble that burst. This bubble was different for a whole host of reasons. Most important, it was a bubble in the financial sector. And the financial system is the lifeline of the economy. It's the artery which carries the blood, if you will, from policymakers to the economy. And when that artery gets clogged and is unable to deliver needed relief, you get something much more severe in terms of the decline in economic activity than a normal recession. And this recession, as you know, was the most severe since the Depression. So that's, I think, the most important reason, or an important reason, for this experience being so much more severe in terms of the economy, the unemployment rate, the equity market, is the bubble was in the most important sector of the economy, because that sector is what transmits credit. It's what transmits funding and financing to individuals, to the corporate sector, and that mechanism, that transmission mechanism, shut down. That's one reason why it was different and severe. The second is it called into question the viability of and sustainability of bank and non-bank institutions. And when you call into question the viability of those institutions and their balance sheets, It's something none of us have had to experience or assess or analyze. So we were almost rudderless in how one approached analytically the consequences of balance sheets evaporating in the financial system. And again, who the counterparties were, who was vulnerable, who wasn't. And that in turn led, without repeating what I said earlier, the broad-based drop in confidence among investors and among consumers. So I think those are the reasons why it was different, both in terms of it being a bubble versus the normal way we go into recessions, and second, where the bubble presented itself. And I think finally, with respect to that, is I think most of us, not all of us, but most of us in the community were unaware as to the extent of leverage in the system undertaken by the banks and non-bank institutions and the shadow banking market. And when things began to unravel, that leverage was more magnified and more significant than any of us, I think, imagined.
Stephen, I have one sort of more broad question to follow up on this, and then I'm going to let you come in. So just to give you a warning and not put you on the spot. So why didn't, in your view, equity markets or regulators or others, whoever you want to comment on, but I guess particularly equity markets, why didn't people see the leverage of financial institutions or the leverage of consumers? Or
I think investors certainly saw the leverage of consumers.
Okay.
That's reasonably transparent in the sense of there are government statistics which show debt service to disposable income, household ownership of household equity in homes. Those were above their long-term averages, clearly, and looked to be worrisome. And there were many who believed that that level of debt in the consumer sector would bring about slower economic activity going forward, could bring about a cyclical contraction in the economy, which we've experienced before. But I think the mindset of most investors was, so long as the economy can continue to grow and income can be generated, these ratios can come down moderately over a number of years. The end result would be that the economy would grow more slowly than had historically been the case, but that it was not subject to anything abrupt or severe. And again, underpinning that were two assumptions, two principal assumptions. One is that the economy would continue to generate jobs and labor income. But second and most important, that home prices were not subject to a sustained, significant, or nationwide decline. And that the leverage that individuals were taking with respect to their homes, refinancing, taking out greater and greater debt against their homes, was not something which would be problematic. Underlying that assumption, home prices would be okay. Okay. So, but having said that, I think on the consumer side, on the financial institution side, it was, I think, reasonably opaque. It was less clear to investors as to the extent of leverage. It was off balance sheet stuff going on that was not readily apparent to investors. What was on the balance sheet, interestingly, as I said earlier, had ratings attached to it, which gave investors some confidence. These baskets of securitized products were okay because they were diversified geographically, they were diversified by income, and they had various tranches, as AAA tranches, AA, and the like. And they were deemed to be reasonably priced, reasonably valued assets on the books of the banks and non-bank institutions. And the fact that home prices did what they did, for the reasons I indicated earlier, kind of eliminated that, the view of that asset, and the asset began to decline in value. And there was more leverage on it that we were unaware of as well. And the combination of more leverage than we were aware of, because it is opaque, the financial statements of financial institutions are quite complicated and at times difficult to fully understand just how much leverage is attached to these products. And more importantly, again, what were the assumptions underlying these securitized products themselves? That is, no home price declines, et cetera. So I think all of that explains why this took investors a bit, not a bit, but took them by surprise and unwound as rapidly as it did. But I would say this, if investors had had the confidence that the financial system itself and substantive bank and non-bank institutions themselves were not on the brink, that mentality could have been contained to the banks will suffer losses, the non-banks will suffer losses, but there will not be a liquidity issue, there will not be a funding issue, there will not be a survival issue. This financial crisis would have been much, much less significant. What made it as severe was investors, and then eventually a broader base, lost confidence in the viability of the system, not of any individual institution. And once it lost confidence in the viability of the system, everything froze.
I try to ask only historical questions, but I have to ask this. Mm-hmm. Do you think we are now in a situation where investors do have confidence in the viability of the financial system? Have we passed the crisis?
I think investors believe now that the tools are available to protect the system from going over the cliff as we thought it might in 2008 and 2009. And a good deal of the credit for that goes to the Federal Reserve for creating terribly imaginative and effective and substantive initiatives outside of the normal, we're going to lower the Fed funds rate to zero. And as you know, there were, I don't know, a dozen different acronyms that provided funding to various elements of the market, the mortgage market, other securitized markets, to non-bank financial institutions, all of which I think encourage people to think we came to the brink and we were successful, some would say successful and lucky, but let's say successful, in not going over based on what the Fed had done, and to the fiscal side as well, but more on the monetary side. So I think investors now have more confidence in the system. Do they think that there are no tail risks? No. Obviously there are tail risks that we confront now that we didn't confront before this, sovereign debt issues in Europe and the implications for banks. The U.S. growing public debt to GDP ratio and the implications of that for economic growth and productivity. So there are tail risks that are the byproduct of a financial tsunami. And we've learned that. And one of the tail risks clearly is as the private sector was deleveraging, which it had to do, the public sector levered up. And now we have the circumstance where investors originally thought mistakenly, okay, private sector delevered, public sector levered, we're home free. We're not, because the public sector deleveraging is not sustainable. You have to somehow grow your way out of that debt. It's not what you leave your children, your grandchildren, that'll...
Sorry, the public sector levering.
Yes.
I thought you said, I may have misheard, but public sector delevering.
No, levering.
Levering.
It
fine.
Is levered. It has to delever at some point, somehow.
Right.
And again, that's a byproduct. So I think when you ask the question, is the set of investors now convinced the system is viable? I think they're more convinced it's viable. The concern now of investors is not so much the viability of the system, but the concern now is what are the consequences longer term of a public sector that was required to lever up to save the system. Now what happens from here? Well, what happens is you grow more slowly, you have bigger government, you have less productivity, and that's what the market is grappling with now. There's this phrase, I don't like it, but it's a phrase, the new normal means we grow more slowly. You know, what does that mean in terms of rate of unemployment? What does it mean in terms of job creation? What does it mean in terms of profit growth? What does it mean in terms of the appetite for risk assets in the U.S. economy? It's always been an important ingredient for growth, the willingness to take risk. What does it mean for Fed policy? What does it mean for inflation? What does it mean for bond interest rates? Those are the issues now that I think confront investors rather than is the system viable. I think we've crossed that bridge, rightly or wrongly, and now accept the system is viable.
Stephen, let me not hog all the time.
Well, for a moment take you back to the time when you left Goldman. That was, I think, 98?
End of 98, correct.
98. That was an interesting time. A number of things were happening, among them LTCM. And I wonder, you know, LTCM was a stunning collapse of credit, liquidity, and leverage risk. Do you think a lesson was lost?
I guess in hindsight, the answer to that question is yes. Although when it was happening, I think most believed it was contained to an organization rather than systemic, and therefore viewed as anomalous rather than broad-based in the system. So, in hindsight, yes, but while it was happening, much, much less clear and apparent that it was or could be more systemic or wide-ranging. And even then, it really wasn't. I mean, if you think back to 1998 and long-term capital, we had no housing bubble. There wasn't a shadow banking system. There was not the leverage in the bank and non-bank financial institutions that we lifted to in the years 2003, 4, 5, 6, and 7. The saving rate had not yet come down to zero. Debt service obligations hadn't gone to a record. So I think it's, Stephen, probably harsh to say it wasn't a lesson learned, because very little of what transpired leading up to this financial tsunami was present or apparent in long-term capital, and I think it was a much more appropriate conclusion at the time to draw that it was a single firm, non-systemic issue. That'd be my view, at least.
So you can almost say it had a counterintuitive effect. I mean, on the one hand, everybody saw that as I said, credit, liquidity, and leverage risk could blow up in an instant. But in the way that it was handled by a number of investment banks, did it lead people, maybe it lulled people into thinking the system was more solid than it turned out to be 10 years later?
Yeah, I think people believed the system was more sustainable. I don't think long-term capital, quite frankly, contributed a lot to that mentality. I think what contributed to that mentality, you have to go way back to when we introduced the bulk of financial market deregulation in the early 1980s. Think about the economic expansions post-1980. We had a bottom in the economy in 1982. We grew until 1990 with obviously a stock market crash at that time, 87, but didn't deter the economy. We had an eight-year economic expansion. The recession that followed was by all measures mild. The average economic expansion in the post-war period had been about four to five years. Okay, this one lasted 8 years. Okay, then we had an economic expansion that went from 1991 to 2001, 10 years. Then we had an economic expansion that went from 2002 to 2007, 2001, 6 years. So the last three economic expansions were 8 years, 10 years, and 6 years, averaging more than double the economic expansions prior to financial market deregulation and the elimination of Regulation Q, which I'm bringing both of you way back, well before you probably cared about any of this stuff. I'm older.
We both have enough gray hair.
Okay, so that's point one I'd make.
You know, Reg Q is very interesting. I'm glad you brought it up. I wasn't sure how would you characterize Reg Q as a factor in the process?
Well, it was important, Stephen. It was important because prior to the elimination of it, how did you stop economic expansions? Disintermediation. Without disintermediation out of the financial institutions, SNLs when they existed, the economy had much more sustainability to it. So my point in response to your question is I don't think long-term capital fed very much this notion of economic sustainability. I think it was the fact the economic expansions, our economic experience itself came...
I think maybe I'm doing a poor job of asking the question. I mean, what we keep hearing now is, I know it was true of Bear Stearns and certainly Lehman Brothers, they said, oh, our liquidity, everything is so fragile. You made the reference yourself that, you know, confidence is so much.
Yes.
And confidence, these are all factors. I don't want to blow up long-term capital be more than it was, but the issues that bankers complained about as being so surprising, you know, that the collapse of those markets, all was visible in long-term capital management. The solution was different, the magnitude was different, but the key elements of the crisis, the collapse in liquidity risk, credit risk, and we've all seen before.
I think that's true, but again, I would stress that at the time, it was not systemic, but rather viewed as anomalous. Now, that turned out to be incorrect for other reasons, and you're right, it was a test, it was a laboratory experience, so to speak. You could see in long-term capital many of the issues that afflicted us in this financial crisis, but I don't think when it happened, as I said, we had any of the other systemic issues, and it was viewed as an isolated example. And
I think we're in agreement. I think that the description of as a lab experience is very good, but the point is, no, I'm not sure anybody took good lessons away from the lab experience.
Yeah, perhaps, but again, I would say, again, on the sustainability, I think it's important because you raised it, this issue of sustainability, I think, was fed much more by the length of economic expansions we experienced beginning in the early 1980s. And if you look at the data, not only was the length increased, the variability of economic activity diminished So the volatility of GDP growth, the volatility of inflation subsided. So not only were we experiencing longer expansions, they were less risky expansions, and that fed into people thinking, well, you heard it when we were doing it, the business cycle is dead. We have learned to control the business cycle, and all of that fed into this enormous leveraging that people were willing to undertake in the decade of the in this last decade, which in fact provided the underpinnings to this financial crisis. But coming back to the original question, I would add, as one of the reasons for the tsunami, that the economic participants came to believe in long-lasting, low-volatility, low-inflation expansions that government had learned to control economic cyclicality. And people begin to believe that. They have more job security. They believe their common stock portfolios will do well. They believe their homes will do well. They believe that their children will do better. And all of that gives you a certain willingness to take on debt. And
that was the great moderation, basically.
Yes.
Well, how many times in your career have you seen that? I mean, you think of the Nifty 50. Everybody had this conviction that how can the Nifty 50 ever go down?
There's
only a limited number of shares, and more people are going to want them. I mean, how many times in your career have you seen similar kinds of periods where everybody becomes convinced of the same thing?
Oh well, there are. A number of those. The Nifty 50 is one of them. Recall in the 70s we had, based on what OPEC was doing with energy prices, that energy stocks were the only place one could be, because energy was going to $200 a barrel. So you had it with 50-50. You had it with energy. If you recall in the 60s, I believe you had this phenomenon of small cap stocks. You had it with internet stocks. The late 90s through 2000. So there have been, just since the 1970s, you had, one is energy, two is you had the Nifty 50, three small cap, and four four of them in the last, I guess, 30 or 40 years. So one, I guess people say, once every 10 years, you're going to get one of these bubbles. But every one of them, with this last exception, I think we'd all admit, was reasonably contained and didn't cause a broad-based, severe, long-lasting impact. This one did.
This is the recent one.
Yeah, this one did because of where the bubble resided and how severe it was. It was in that sector, which I've said is the lifeline, the bloodline to the economy. And it's the funding for, mortgages for individuals and commercial industrial loans for companies. And once it begins to afflict companies, they don't pay dividends as much. They don't buy their shares back. They don't invest. It's a vicious cycle that develops. That's why this one was so different. And this one is different, as I indicated, because there's an aftershock to it. There was not a big aftershock to the internet bubble bursting. There wasn't a big aftershock to the Nifty 50. This one has a big aftershock because it took the government levering up its balance sheet to save us. And once you lever it up, the game isn't over. You now got to contend with what the heck do you do with, trillion-dollar deficits for as far as the eye can see, budget deficits that are 13% of GDP, when we used to think 6 was a lot. You've got to unwind that. And there are implications, broad-based implications, as you unwind it. And that's what we're confronting now. Other bubbles had contained, short-lived hangovers. This one will have a long-lived, sustainable hangover because of how we had to protect against it. That's the difference.
I know you're running out of time, and Kim, can I ask another question?
Keep going.
If I do this section, this portion of this report that I'm assigned to do well, I'm thinking of it in terms of a number of tectonic plates pushing together that kind of erupted in 2008. And the tectonic plates that I see are, and this is reaching, and since I'm taking advantage of your memory, this reaches back to the disintermediation of the 70s, where you had the money market mutual funds, you had the commercial paper market. The other tectonic plate is housing, and of course that takes in securitization. And the third one is deregulation, which you've just been talking about. Those seem to me to be three plates, all of which, you know, pushed together, and finally the eruption was what we saw 2 years ago. Granted, I'm a journalist and trying to oversimplify everything, but is that reasonable?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is there any, it seems the, I'm actually going back in terms of looking, you know, I'm reaching the scenario, the story as I see it, the first inklings of systemic risk after the Second World War, where the federal government had to get involved, was at Penn Central. And they came in to rescue the commercial paper market. And then the story moves to Franklin National, where they actually demonstrated that systemic risk isn't just domestic, it's international. And then, of course, the next development is Louis Ranieri and securitization, right, which, of course, redefines finance in the end of the century. And that, of course, you know, part of so much.
Right. But again, I think that, you know, again, I don't want to be a psychologist about this, but the creation of this product, the securitization, the securitized product, and the innovations that took place within the financial sector, there has to be a buyer and a seller, that is, a willingness to take on this debt or participate in financially innovative products. And I do think this financial market deregulation starting in the early 1980s, which allowed for prolonged expansions that were much less volatile, did encourage economic participants in the U.S. to accept the leverage lift in the consumer and business and financial sectors. So there was a mentality that permeated based on economic experience. And, you know, forget the macro, just micro, people you know, friends, acquaintances, when things are going well, there's a willingness to add debt because you believe you'll be able to pay it back because you'll have the income to do so. Your portfolio of assets will appreciate, and you're more open and willing to it. And one of the challenges, I mentioned the public sector, now debt as a challenge. One other challenge we face is now economic participants in the U.S. Have a completely reversed mentality. They don't want, they feel so bad about the outlook. The corporate sector has $2 trillion of cash on its balance sheet and it won't spend it. Consumers have lifted their saving rate from 0% to 7% in less than a year. So now we confront the reverse of the feel-good time. We now have we feel bad times, and that will bring slower economic growth. So Stephen, in a sense, we're reversing an awful lot of what, as we should, reversing an awful lot of what caused the financial tsunami of 08 and 09 and the build-up to it, which is an important and positive corrective process, but it's not painless because it'll bring slower growth, higher rates of unemployment, and less opportunity for our citizens.
One quick question more. When Gramm-Leach Bliley, and this comes back to 98 again, and this deregulation issue, did Gramm-Leach Bliley for you sort of cap this whole process of deregulation?
You what?
Gramm-Leach Bliley?
Gramm-Leach Bliley Act of 1998. You remember?
I don't know by the name. What did it do?
Oh, good. The fact that you don't remember it tells me enough. You know, I mean,
Oh, that, I don't know the name. Okay, yeah, the end of Glass-Steagall. So the question is,
there was an act, and Congress passed an act called the Gramm-Leach Lively.
Oh, Grantley Leach.
And that was actually in response when Citicorp, the Travelers merged.
Right.
And that was the legislation that led to that legislation. I don't want to belabor this. That's enough said on that.
No, I didn't understand the words. The end of Glass-Steagall and the ability that gave banking institutions to do what they did in terms of diversifying to non-bank institutions, leverage and the like, less regulation, certainly was a contributor to what we experienced, one of many, but certainly a contributor to what we experienced in 2008 and early 2009.
Okay, I'm sorry. The advantage of talking to someone with a perspective is hard to resist. So, but Kim, if you want to sort of,
I do have two more, and I don't want to overstay if you have other commitments.
Sure.
Just to probe just a little more, the difference between a bubble in the equity markets, which is generally what has occurred, although there have been commercial real estate bubbles, et cetera, and what we just experienced with the bubble as you described it within the financial system mm-hmm. itself. Some people have said, well, it's within the debt markets. I think it's interesting to say it's within the financial system itself.
Yeah, I don't think it's a debt. Yeah, I think debt market is much too narrow a description.
So is it partly that when there's an equity bubble, we have pretty clear regulation, we have pretty clear margin requirements, and there just aren't knock-on effects? There's pain,
mm-hmm.
but it's swift, it's deep. And then it's over.
I think the key word you use, and I agree with, is knock-on. There are very few. There's not much of a knock-on effect to the broad-based economy or to consumers or to businesses. It's an equity market issue. Now, there's pain, certainly, and portfolios go down in value and people feel less wealthy. But no, it's not near as broad-based an impact having an equity market bubble in tech stocks or in Nifty 50 stocks or small cap stocks, because it doesn't affect or afflict major portions of the population in terms of their day-to-day functioning. Businesses are still able to borrow and expand capacity. Companies are still hiring. Individuals are still spending. And governments aren't running big deficits as a consequence. So there's no knock-on, that is, equity market comes down and all of a sudden, you know, liquidity disappears, lending disappears, bank balance sheets are vulnerable, non-bank sources of financing, none of that happens, nor should it happen, given the source of the bubble. This one, for reasons I've already indicated, had those knock-on effects and therefore required the initiatives the Fed took. I mean, none of the other bubbles we've ever experienced ever required the Fed to do anything remotely resembling what it did. The Fed sometimes had to cut rates because consumer net worth was coming, you know, normal stuff. The Fed didn't have to lift its balance sheet from $700 billion to $2.3 trillion in a year because the internet bubble burst or because Nifty 50 stocks didn't work, but they did for this one. So it was the source of it and the systemic nature of it. Not only the source, but the systemic nature. It was, you know, when you don't know, as an economic agent, you freeze. You freeze. And banks froze. They stopped lending to other institutions that were dependent on that lending. And the minute that happens, you know, those other institutions have inventory that's got to be funded. If not, the prices come down. Then you ask yourself, gee, you know, this XYZ non-bank has X billions of dollars in inventory marked here, depending upon liquidity from XYZ bank. That liquidity's gone. What is that now worth? Well, you don't know. And also you don't know the counterparty to this inventory and what the consequences are to them and where they're located. Are they located in France? Are they located in Germany? Are they located in the U.S.? So that uncertainty brings a freezing of the system. And that was at the core what caused the crisis, is everything froze. And when it froze, the economy sunk. And once it sunk, you had a financial sector impact on the real economy that was unparalleled, at least in the post-war period. Then all of a sudden companies said, geez, maybe there's no financing for my inventory. Maybe I can't build that plant I thought I could build because the debt markets are closed. So what am I going to do? I'm not going to hire as much. Unemployment goes up. Workers see their wages slow in growth. They see their jobs disappear. What do? They retrench. And that process of the financial sector sitting on the real economy then is self-reinforcing. That's what happened, which is different than the bubbles that you described.
Also stepping back to explore something you said before about derivatives and counterparty risk, and that was, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that it seemed that you were saying that was an important part of the panic, because it was unknown.
It's opaque.
And do you, in your view of that, do you differentiate in any way between credit derivatives, which are a newer development, mm-hmm. and other types of over-the-counter derivatives?
Yeah.
Yes.
The question, I'm sorry.
Credit derivatives versus other derivatives.
I think because we had and have had more experience with equity derivatives than the credit ones, I do differentiate because we've had more experience with them. And so that's my answer, yes. We have more experience with the non-equity, with the equity derivatives. Having said that, they're opaque as well, just the credit ones were more opaque and newer, and we didn't fully understand their systemic implications because we haven't had experience with them before.
I've found this extremely instructive. Stephen, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, but I hope I can. I hope, Steve, you wouldn't mind being contacted again if a question arises, especially with the requires some historic
email. Okay.
So this was very helpful to me, too.
Thank you. I look forward to what it is you write.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
We're concluding at 12:05. Thank you very much, Steve.
Okay.